Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Luke. So it's really nice to be here. I was a postdoc here for basically like almost 3 years, not too long ago. So I have like really fond memories of Perimeter, and that's actually where some of this work originated. So right now I'm at the Flatiron Institute, as Luke said. So I wanted to start by telling you all briefly about that because it's a new place. Just kind of a little plug for Flatiron. So this is a neat picture I found of New York City that shows you can see where we are on there. So if you look right here, that's the Flatiron building. It's a building that's kind of shaped like a triangle. If you take like a bird's eye view, that's Fifth Avenue. Madison Square Park is right there. So we're right next to it. Some people ask, are we in the Flatiron building? No, we're next to it. Also, we're not in Boulder, Colorado, the Flatirons. So what we are is we're a division of the Simons Foundation. Who's heard of the Simons Foundation before? Okay, so a good number of people. So they're, you know, they support like the archive. They give a lot of these collaboration grants, It from Qubit, Mini Electron, all these different ones. So they fund a lot of science right now. And they have this idea of bringing scientists, you know, in-house. So we're kind of like a unit of the foundation, but we're in a different building across the street. And our mission is to advance scientific research, not just physics, but these different areas, through computational methods, data analysis, modeling, simulations. So this includes algorithm development, working with data sets, open source software, training, all these things, as well as just publications. And right now, there's 3 centers, and a 4th one is soon to come. And the centers involve computational astrophysics, computational biology. I'm in the Computational Quantum Physics Center, and we represent a broad range of numerical techniques like Monte Carlo, DMFT, Amin Tensor Networks, more to come there. And a 4th center that's being worked on right now, which may be, it's not clear what it's going to be, but it may be some applied math, maybe neuroscience, maybe earth sciences, is still being debated. So look forward to that. Let me know if you have any questions about that place. So now to the talk. So the idea of the talk today is to tell you about tensor networks. This is the topic I work on. Traditionally, they've been mostly used for studying condensed matter physics problems, so like lattice models of materials. Also, you can use them for classical physics in interesting ways that I think they've been kind of underused in that area. But the thing is, in general, tensor networks are really a mathematical tool that could be used a lot more broadly. And some applied mathematicians in recent years have begun to realize this, and I got interested in it as well from that perspective. So I've been working on it in that direction. And when you use them, when you think of tensor networks as a more general mathematical tool, you realize, well, wait, I could use them not only in physics, but I could use them in like other areas like machine learning. And when you do this, you get models that relate to other known models in machine learning, but have interesting differences like in terms of the architecture that lead to interesting capabilities and algorithms. Like for example, they can be adaptive, I'll show you how, where the number of weights in the model can automatically grow and shrink during training to adapt for the complexity of the problem you're trying to solve. I'll show you about that. And also at the end, I'll talk about how these can connect to quantum computing. So like if you have a quantum computer, or you're building a quantum computer, and you want to do machine learning, which I believe is actually a good application of quantum computing, then should you pick a neural network? Should you pick kernel learning? What should you pick? I'll kind of argue that tensor networks have a natural fit on a quantum computer, because in fact, tensor networks basically are quantum circuits. So they're kind of already ready to go for quantum computing in some sense. So now, why machine learning? I don't think I have to motivate that too much to this audience here. I've been hearing that people here are very energized by this topic. But basically, I think it's just sort of like jealousy that, you know, we're doing physics and science, and then, you know, that's fun, but then we see people having even more fun, you know, making cars drive themselves, and we're like, wait, like that looks extra fun. And or they're making computers that can like talk to you. And then also, I would say an important reason is that, I was looking at what kind of jobs can you get within academia and what outside of academia, and a lot of the jobs have kind of negative aspects to them where, you know, maybe you're, you know, it's kind of neutral or you're even hurting people or something with what you do. But machine learning, you can do very positive things. Like I think machine learning is going to have a really big impact on medicine. And I think it's going to lead to very nice outcomes for like elderly people, disabled people. So I think that's a really cool reason to be interested in machine learning. And then turning it back on science. I think that's a very exciting reason because, you know, science underpins everything. So there's all these different areas in science, like high throughput material science, condensed matter physics, astronomy, and like high energy physics that are all starting to find productive ways of using machine learning to advance their core scientific goals. So those are all really good reasons. Also, it's just a hot topic. So just I could show many slides about how hot of a topic it is, I think we all know. But just to show the kind of level that this has reached, Google has basically officially announced that they're like an AI first company, I think at one of their recent meetings like last year. or you know, machine learning first company. And so part of this is because they had a whole team of linguists behind their Google Translate feature for many years. Then their neural net people came along and tried to beat that. And they really trounced the linguistic approach just with neural nets. So now Google Translate uses neural nets. They have a team working on quantum computing, and they're very interested in machine learning. And there's this article talking about now that the people who sit closest to the CEO are the Google Brain team. You know, that's really the heart of Google now, more than search or something. So anyway, it's a big deal there, of course. And then also, it just seems like magic, basically. So we kind of want to understand machine learning, because it can do these things that seem just impossible, especially if you try to think about programming in a traditional logical way. And so here's an example of something that's kind of like magic, where you train this model that can generate pictures of men wearing glasses, just pictures of men without glasses, pictures of women without glasses. Then you take the different inputs that lead to these outputs, and you do this arithmetic, man with glasses minus man plus woman, and then you start generating from that latent vector, and then you get pictures of women wearing glasses. And the wild thing is that these men, the glasses are in different orientations, but somehow when the women's face is you know, oriented a certain way, the glasses are correctly oriented too. You know, and that's like kind of like magic. Somehow it knows how to position the glasses onto the eyes correctly and everything. So, you know, pretty amazing. And then I could show you slide after slide after slide of, you know, these amazing results that people are getting with these approaches. But now what's interesting for us as physicists is that if we look at this field more mathematically, like what's the bones of this field kind of, there's a lot of physics ideas everywhere. And some of this really historically came from physics. Some of it, you know, came out of this field. And there's been all this back and forth between physics and machine learning. And a key example is a Boltzmann machine, which is not, you know, necessarily a state-of-the-art method for practical things, although it, you know, works pretty well for, in some cases. But it's been studied a lot for academic purposes, at least. And it's literally a disordered Ising model. Like, there's no difference at all. It's literally an Ising model with random couplings between the spins. And you think of the couplings as parameters to be learned. Then you sample from that disordered Ising model, and the samples can look like real-world data if you train them correctly. There's also things like deep belief networks and variational autoencoders and things like that that have aspects of the renormalization group. I mean, it's still debatable, you know, how much is this connection meaningful and all that, but still it makes you think about the renormalization group. You think about compression and these ideas. So it's just a sort of a motivating idea. And then in particular, there's an idea in machine learning called a convolutional neural network that's very important for image processing. And this is what made me think about tensor networks in part. I was actually sharing an office here with Juan Carrasquilla, who's now at Vector down the road in Toronto. And he was drawing these on the board and talking about them to me. And I kept saying they look like wave functions. And the reason I was saying that is that they have these mixing layers followed by these pooling layers. And here, there are these functions with nonlinearities. This other thing that I know about called a Mira tensor network that was originated by Guifré Vidal, who's also here, also have some similar aspects. There's differences, key differences, but still there's these mixing layers that are called disentanglers. Then there's these pooling layers that are like these RG isometry things. So I thought, you know, that's interesting that there's some overlap between these, at least at the space of ideas. So it just made me wonder, are tensor networks useful for machine learning somewhere? Like, they seem to be in some common space of ideas. Can we use them somewhere? And then I hope I'll convince you that when you use them in machine learning in a certain way, they as weights of machine learning models, that they're useful and interesting. And then I'll show you that they already give you benefits like linear scaling in the training set size, which has been a key property that neural nets have that make them scalable to big data, but which other approaches to machine learning historically have lacked, this linear scaling. Adaptive weights, which is pretty novel for most any method of machine learning.
What scaling does usually?
I'll say more about that, but what I mean is that basically in the training set size. So you take some huge data set involving, you know, millions of images or sound clips or something, and historically in the 90s, these methods called kernel methods would scale like the cube of that number. And so if that number was like 1,000 and you're in the 1990s and you don't have that much, that big of hard drives and your internet is slow, you don't have big data at that time. So 1,000 is fine. That's kind of all you have anyway. But now we have ImageNet or something with, you know, hundreds of thousands of images or even millions of images. And if your method scales as the cube of that, that's unacceptable. You won't never finish running. But if it scales linearly, you can deal. Training time of your algorithm. And in fact, with kernel learning, it's also, even to evaluate the model, has some dependence on training set size.
So sorry, when you say kernel learning, do you
I haven't defined that yet, but No, I mean a separate, this is an older thing from neural networks. So I'll talk more about all this, but the idea is that besides neural networks, there's other methods people still use that are interesting. They're interesting methods, but they don't scale very well. This is one of those methods, but it does scale well. So just to make the point that the tensor networks give a benefit in the domain where they work. And then they also give you adaptive weights, which is pretty novel, I think, for almost any method of machine learning. You don't see that too often, meaning that the number of parameters can grow and shrink automatically with the complexity of your problem. There's some aspect of these methods where you can actually have them learn how to represent the data on the way to solving the problem. So sort of an RG idea. I'll talk more about that. And then there's future benefits I'm still working on, and I'm hoping to get people like you interested in working on, and there's other people now working on this. Pushing interpretability, because everything in a tensor network is linear in a high-dimensional space, and linearity is something that makes it easier to think about. So that's something I think that we could still see this will bear a lot of fruit in the area of interpretability and doing good quality theory. Better algorithms, closely related idea. If you can do better theory about these, you can develop more sophisticated algorithms for training them. And then quantum computing, and I'll talk about that connection at the end. Okay, so now I'm going to give kind of a long introductory part about what's machine learning, what are tensor networks, and finally I'll connect those up. So let me know if you have some questions as I go through this. But I'll hopefully explain everything I mentioned on that last slide. Okay, so very briefly, you know, what is machine learning? Like, how can we think about defining it? So I won't succeed at defining it, but I'll give you some attempt to define it. You could say it's data-driven problem solving. So instead of coming at the problem and being like, here's what I think the problem is and how to solve it, you say, you know, I just have data, and then the data itself will sort of drive me to a solution, basically. And so what I mean by that is that any automated system that as you feed in more data just gets better and better and better at doing some task. But maybe the part in the middle that links up the data to the success of the task is something that maybe you kind of set in motion, but then it kind of goes on its own, and you don't quite know, like, what did it do with the data necessarily. So that part is kind of, that's the mysterious part about it. And then it's really just a framework. There's lots of different methods, lots of different ideas from statistics, ideas from algorithms, and, you know, coming up with different models. So it's not just like a single method. But what it looks like in more kind of nuts and bolts, practically speaking, is that you're trying to find functions that solve problems you're interested in. So you have a function, I just want to like go off in the space of functions and find some function that solves my problem. And so your problem may be that given images and thinking of them as vectors, like a vector of all the pixels in some high dimensional space, I want to find a function that outputs either 1, 0 if it's a picture of a dog, or 0, 1 if it's a picture of a cat. Right? So I feed in pictures of dogs and cats, and I just want to find a function that does this task. You know, like there's the data, output one of those two vectors. Or maybe if it's some mixture of the vectors, I take whichever component is the biggest, and then that's the output. So the philosophy here is that there should be some function that does this. I mean, why not, right? Like, if I can do it, then I'm the function, essentially, that can do that. You know, but so there's some function in the space of all possible functions that can separate dogs from cats. But you can't really work in the space of all functions. So what you do instead is you say, let me just pick some set of functions that's very, very flexible, meaning like it can fit lots of things, it can model lots of things. And then here is a little bit different from maybe what we think about doing in physics, where we think about curve fitting. In physics, we're kind of thinking about like, I want to pick the right function, meaning like, you know, I know my thing is analytic, so I know I can represent it as a Taylor series, so I pick a low order polynomial. So we have this sense of like, this is the right set of functions, we just don't know a few of the parameters. Here it's more like, we don't care if it's the right set of functions, it's just functions that just do stuff, you know, it'll become right by the way we train it. I mean, that's not necessarily fair, but that's maybe just to kind of emphasize there's a slight difference of philosophy. And then that's what I mean by you prefer sort of convenient functions somewhat over correct functions. Not totally true, I don't want to be misleading, but that's a bit how you start thinking about it. And then the key thing, though, is you say, well, the way I'll be principled about this, though, is that I will order these functions that can sort of fit anything from more simple to less simple, and I'll prefer, of all the different functions that can solve my problem, I'll prefer the simpler ones for some appropriate definition of simple. And so just the key example of this is, let's say I'm given training data that is missing some pieces, like I don't know what's going on here, I don't know what's going on there. I can fit this different ways, and then I have some notion that this smoother function is simpler, because it's smoother, basically. Maybe it's a lower order polynomial. And so then I pick that one, and then sure enough, that one is more likely to fit my unseen data. Okay, so we're all familiar with that idea. So then in some sense, that idea is just statistics. It's like, how do you take a poll of a population and then generalize it to the whole population or something like that. Okay, and then just to define some terminology, words you hear thrown around with in the context of machine learning are supervised learning, and this basically is a term of art that just means that you're given a data set, and the data set comes with accurate labels. And so the idea is that somebody's like supervising the data and assigning these labels for you, telling you what the labels are to the data. And then your job is to find a decision function. And there's different ways of constructing this decision function. But a simple way is if you have two classes, you want to find a function that always gives a positive output if the input is x and always gives a negative output if the input is a b kind of input. And so A and B could be pictures of alligators and bears. And so positive means you run away and negative means you play dead. How should you react to an alligator or a bear? Something like that. And you can generalize this to multi-classes in different ways. But that's the idea of supervised learning, is you're given labels, and then you want to discriminate new inputs that fall into these label types. Then there's unsupervised learning, and this is a bit more of a broad and kind of nebulous area, so you can define it different ways. It's a little bit harder to define. Basically, it just means meaningful things you can learn about unlabeled data. That's really all unsupervised learning means. So this is a big area, because it's like most data that you collect, you don't already know what it is. You're just collecting data. Like, for example, if you're looking at movies, you don't already necessarily know what are all the possible genres of movies people might be interested in. There might be very niche genres you don't know to think about until you look at the data and you realize, oh, there's this very specific genre about, you know, movies featuring vampires with a strong female lead or something like that. So you may not know that a priori. So different kinds of unsupervised learning are one idea is that you imagine your data comes from some hidden unknown probability distribution. So something is generating movies. So there's some Hollywood, you know, distribution function. And then you're trying to fit some other function that in your model class to approximate the true hidden probability distribution of the data. So that's one mode of unsupervised learning. Another one briefly is that you could also say, well, I want the square of that function to be the probability. That's like kind of a quantum, you know, version of machine learning. You could ask, why would I want to do that? But I could give you some reasons. But then there's other very different things you can do that still count as unsupervised learning. So the one that's like that movie genre idea is taking data and trying to find clusters. So you say, here's the data, but then you look at it and you realize it's all lumped into different groups. And then you try to find ways to divide the data into these different groups. And you want to count how many different clusters or groups are there. That's a very powerful and useful thing. And then there's also pre-processing data, like taking the data and finding some compressed form of it or some summary of it that makes it a better input to some other task later on, like a different kind of unsupervised learning or supervised learning or other things. So that's sort of machine learning in a nutshell. Okay, any questions about any of that? That was like a lightning introduction to machine learning. Okay, so now the other part I need before I combine tensor networks and machine learning is tensor networks. So what are tensor networks? So tensor networks, at least the way I learned about them, come from quantum mechanics. But there's other ways you can motivate them. But you know, that's the way historically they've been motivated, is we think of them as a tool for working with many-body quantum systems. So what do we mean by many-body quantum systems? Well, the paradigmatic one that I want to think about, just think about a 1D lattice model world. And think about, on each of these lattice sites, there's a spin a half. And then I'm interested in, say, in low energy or ground states, you know, the dominant eigenvector of this Hermitian matrix, which we call the Hamiltonian. And an example of a Hamiltonian would be this transverse-field Ising model. And it has this behavior that when this term H is very small, the spins just want to align. But they can align one of two different ways, all up or all down. But when this field is very large, they all just point to the right. And there's only one solution for the ground state. And then in between, they can do these wild fluctuations and exhibit criticality. It's very interesting. So it's very tough to solve this model in between, because if you try to go at it with brute force, the object you're looking for is the wave function. And what's the wave function? The wave function is really just a map. It really, like, the function, right, is just a rule. It's a map. It's a map that maps spin configurations to complex numbers. And those complex numbers are what we call the wave function. So if I give you one of the possible 2 to the n different spin configurations of this lattice model, then your job is to hand me a complex number. And the point of that complex number is if I square it, it gives me the probability of seeing that configuration, right? So the problem with this is that there's 2 to the n configurations. So the simplest way to deal with the wave function is just to try to store the whole wave function. We have to store 2 to the n complex numbers. That doesn't scale. Plus, if you try to work with that, it's even more costly. It's very bad. So you can only deal with up to maybe like 20 spins this way or something. It's really rough going. But then you think about it and you're like, wait, a function is just a rule. It's just a map that takes me from spin configurations to numbers. And I can implement that map any way I want. So I can just pick this different rule, right? Instead of just handing you the number because I stored it in a big array, I can hand you the number this way. I can say, anytime you see an upspin, replace it by a matrix called mup. Anytime you see a downspin, replace it by a matrix called mdown. Now these matrices can be completely arbitrary and independent of each other. The only constraint is they have to have the same size on the same site. So whatever site I do this on, two matrices, the same dimensions, just completely different numbers in these two matrices if you want. And you have to kind of just let me do this rule. I'll explain more why this is a good rule in a minute, but this is just some rule. Then the way I give you this amplitude, this wave function component, is I look at the spin configuration, and then I just replace the spins by these matrices. So I go mup, mdown, mup, mup, mdown, and that matches the up, down pattern. And then I arrange things, I didn't want the notation to get too heavy. I arrange things so that all the product of these matrices results in a scalar. So the first matrix is 1 by something, and the last matrix is something by 1. So the row size is 1 and the column size is 1 at the ends. So in the end, I get a number when I multiply all these matrices together. But in the middle, these are some kind of close to square size matrices. And then I just can do this for every different configuration. I can say, OK, new configuration, up, up, down, down, down. And I just multiply those matrices and keep doing that. OK, any questions about that slide? Because that's an important slide to
understand. So all matrices are different here, right?
Could be. They may not be. They may be. But in general, they can all be different from each other as long as at the same site, M3 up and M3 down have to have the same size. That's the only constraint here. And that the row size of M1 is 1 and the column size of M5 is 1. So I get a number at the end,
The M goal is to assign a real number to the spin configuration at the end?
Correct. That really is what a wave function is. A wave function is some rule that assigns a number to a spin configuration. Exactly.
Well, approaching the problem a priori, how is your approach any more...
Why is it better than some other rule?
Than using a... dividing that space of 6 numbers, into 32 percentiles.
Good. So that's why I wrote that slide, was to make you ask that question so I can answer it on the slide. So that's the no. That's a great question. So I mean, are you asking why is this rule a good rule, like versus some other rule? Or yeah, exactly. So that's a really good question. So why this rule? Historically, this rule actually came from an algorithm, and it kind of emerged. The algorithm was a very smart algorithm called DMRG, and this rule kind of emerged out of that. But this is the not historical introduction. So. The way to motivate this rule is to actually, I'll motivate it some different ways, but the key is that it's a massive compression. That's one motivation. So the full wave function would be 2 to the n amplitudes, 2 to the n complex numbers, where n is the number of spins. But this thing only has 2 times n times m squared parameters. So the idea is I go from an exponential to a linear number of parameters in the system size. So I want to study really big systems, hundreds or thousands of spins, and this only will have a linear overhead in terms of storage. To do that. And yet, it can represent any wave function if I take this number m to be big enough. Now, to represent really any wave function, I have to take that number. M is the size of these matrices, so they're m by m matrices in the middle of the chain. It's called the bond dimension. Now, I really have to take that to be exponential to represent anything, so I don't gain anything. But the name of the game here is that you want to walk this number up from like 1, 2, 10, 100, 1,000, and then you hope that maybe by the time you reach 100 or 500 or 1,000, you've basically gotten nearly perfect accuracy for the particular wave function you're interested in. And that happens very often. In fact, there's a proof that that will happen in 1D for a particular very large class of systems in 1D. So in some sense, this is really what wave functions look like for 1D systems of a certain type, which is a very common type I'll tell you more about. So it's this really kind of cool insight into what wave functions really are like. I motivated it in the sense of wave functions, but it's really just one way to compress a really big tensor. So this wave function psi is really just a big tensor with, here are 5 indices or n indices, and this is a massive compression of this tensor. Happens to work well for wave functions, but it could also work for other things. And again, the compression, I mean that you've gotten away with representing 2 to the n different numbers using only 2 n numbers times m squared. And m is like 100 or something. That's the key point. Okay. So why are these useful, let's say, in physics, first of all? So one reason is that they have a lot of nice theory associated with them. As I said, if you have large enough matrices in this chain, and large enough usually only means like 100 or 500 or something, linear dimension, you can represent most any wave function. And then if it's really big, if it's exponentially big, you can literally represent any wave function. There's a proof from 2007 that all one-dimensional systems with exponentially decaying correlations, and this really means like a gap in the energy spectrum, are in some sense close to matrix product states in some bounded way. So you can really represent this huge class of ground states of these, I meant to say ground states, you know, with this form. And in practice, as you make this bond dimension bigger and bigger and bigger, the error you make in different observables goes down very rapidly. So it's very useful. And there's a really nice algorithm to optimize these. And this algorithm is called DMRG. And I'm not going to explain it in great detail. But basically, you sweep back and forth across the system, meaning you just go up and down the chain and optimize these matrices in two at a time. And then you see very rapid convergence to the ground state. So this is actually a parallel DMRG calculation. So I'm doing this on four computers, but just one system. And these walkers each have some region they're assigned to, and they meet and exchange information. And then you can see already the properties have converged very clearly. Like this property that I'm plotting is just the local energy term on every bond of this spin chain. And then you can see they all agree and get a very accurate result for the total energy at the end. And so basically, as you do sweep after sweep after sweep, in the best case, you're basically just putting on the next digit of energy. It's like exponential convergence. So it's really nice. And so that led this guy, Terry Giamarchi, to quote that in one dimension, it's at the moment the closest to an ultimate weapon as one can dream of. So I'm not trying to say, you know, it's the best method for everything, but it's really kind of destroyed certain class of one-dimensional physics problems. So a big program in this tensor network area is to try to extend this success out to other kinds of problems and other dimensions and more complicated systems besides just lattice models. So we really like this method. Just to very briefly flash some applications, right now me and some collaborators are using it to do very high accuracy quantum chemistry. So this is showing, this is just a cartoon of a hydrogen chain, but this is showing real results. This is a density profile of an actual chain of 3D hydrogen atoms that we're simulating with this technique. I'm going to skip over that slide. And then you can also deal with very complicated 2D systems. This is showing some state-of-the-art results for the 2D Kagame model, which is this very difficult lattice model in condensed matter physics. This other plot is showing a time evolution simulation of bosons trapped in a 2D plane, and then they're released, and you see that depending on what properties you, what interactions you give them, they either can fly apart or stay trapped. But this was all simulated using these matrix product states. So they're very powerful for studying physics problems. Okay, that's just to kind of flash up the fact that we use them all the time in physics, and they're very powerful. So then that motivates wanting to use them in other areas, like machine learning. Okay, one last bit about tensor networks, just to help you understand the rest of what I'm going to say, is that we use these tensor diagram notation. We use this tensor diagram notation to work with tensor networks, and it's very powerful. So a matrix product state is really the kind of seminal example of a tensor network, but I'll show you some generalizations of it in a minute. So what we do when we're working with these matrix product states and then these other representations that I'm going to call tensor networks is that whenever we encounter a tensor like the wave function, something with a certain number of indices, we represent it by a shape, some kind of blob or circle or square. And then the indices we represent by lines coming out of that shape. So this tensor has n indices, so we just replace it by a blob with n lines coming out. And when I say tensor, I just want to be clear that I don't mean like some kind of metric tensor or some kind of, you know, moment of inertia tensor or something like that that has some very special transformation properties or some kind of geometrical properties. I might mean that, but I also might not mean that. I really just mean like some large multidimensional array of numbers, and I'm not assuming any particular symmetries or anything like that. So let me show you how this notation works for some simple tensors. So, you know, a very simple kind of tensor is a vector, just a tensor with one index. So that's just some shape with one line coming out of it. And I can put the label, I can name the indices if I want, but I don't have to. A matrix is a tensor with two indices. So it's just a circle with two lines coming out. There's a tensor with three indices, three lines coming out. And then the key rule, or the key benefit of this notation, is that when I join two lines, that applies a contraction, meaning a summation over a pair of matching indices. So here I'm showing the diagram for matrix vector multiplication. So that's just where I take the column index of a matrix and contract it with the single index of a vector. And you know, over here I have to come up with names for all the indices. I have to hunt for where they are and say, okay, there's the column index connected to that index. Then I have to write a big sigma in front. It's really cumbersome notation. Over here, I just draw the two shapes and I join two of the lines. It's very nice. And then that frees me from having to name everything all the time, which can be very burdensome when you're doing very complicated manipulations. So I just have two matrices. They're matrices I can tell because they both have two indices. I join them on one index, that is whatever it is, and I can see that the result is a matrix because there's two lines left over sticking out. And sure enough, that's actually the product of two matrices, and we know that does give a matrix. And then one last example is I take two matrices and I do this with them, and I already know that this is scalar because there's no line sticking out, but I don't necessarily have to name the indices or use any complicated notation. But if I want to use complicated notation, I can write it in traditional form, and this is the trace of the product of two matrices. So as we know, that does give a scalar. Okay, any questions about that notation before I go on? Okay, great. I think a lot of you have seen that notation too. So why do we use that notation? Well, because we have to deal with things like this. So I already introduced previously a matrix product state, but kind of in a more friendly way. Here's the like really unfriendly way of writing a matrix product state, where I write out all of the tensors in complete detail. So there are, instead of saying I have two matrices m up and down, I just let them be notated by the spin index. So that spin index could take values, you know, up or down. But also these things are matrices, at least in the middle here. So they carry two other indices, like a row index and a column index. So really, they're order three tensors. So then I can express this whole sum, this whole contraction of all these things in this diagram. But then once I represent it as the diagram, I don't have to come up with names for all these internal indices anymore. I can just omit those names. I don't even have to write the names of the site indices anymore. So it's much lighter notation. Plus, I can kind of visualize this object and kind of reason better about its properties and its structure by having a visualization of it. Okay. Great. So that's that matrix product state form for the wave function that I introduced a few slides ago, written in this diagrammatic form. And then once you have this diagrammatic form, it becomes a lot easier to discuss extensions of matrix product states. So this field of tensor networks is working very hard to try to push the success of matrix product states for 1D systems to other kinds of systems in physics, so including 2D systems, also critical systems, which kind of are like an exceptional case in 1D. And so, you know, a lot of that work is actually going on here at Perimeter. This is just one slide about that work, but two of the main extensions that people are researching that are extensions of matrix product states for other kind of systems in physics are called PEPs, which have kind of a strange name. I'm not going to explain the name, but they're basically two-dimensional matrix product states. It's like you take the idea of a matrix product state and you just make like a grid of tensors instead of a chain of tensors. And then there's MIRA, which is this idea of adding depth to a matrix product state, basically. So you say instead of it just being like a flat chain of tensors, I have this additional scale dimension, this kind of artificial dimension. This might remind you of like a deep neural network, although it's a different thing, which has to do with renormalization group ideas. So I kind of coarse grain the system, and then these tensors are implementing an RG, and I can also reverse that RG, and I could think about doing something up here and then kind of going down back to the original microscopic scale. So these are both very interesting things, and there's tons of work about them, and I encourage you to learn more about them. So now tensor networks for machine learning, right? So we have this tool, it's very powerful. We have this nice notation for working with it and nice algorithms. Can we use it in machine learning in some way, and what do we get by doing that? And this was some work I did here and in collaboration with my colleague David Schwab, who also now works in New York City at CUNY. So the idea we had was, let's kind of think about a concrete setting to explain this idea in. And the concrete setting is, let's imagine grayscale image data. So I have some images, and this is called the MNIST data set. It's a collection of handwritten digits. And I want to set myself the task of distinguishing these digits. So you show me one of these, and I tell you that's a 4, that's a 3, that's a 2. So these are just grayscale images. So I want to think of them as vectors. I just take all the pixels and put them into a vector. And I represent the pixels as real numbers between 0 and 1. So maybe 0 is white, and 1 is black, and gray is in between. And then I just want to make some big flexible function that I can parameterize and optimize that could be a good function to discriminate these different digits. In practice, it needs to have a vector-valued output to do 10 digits, but here I'm just showing you the scalar case just for simplicity. This form of the function was actually put forward by this paper that came out the same time as ours that's really a creative paper, so I encourage you to take a look at that one. It's called Exponential Machines, but it's equivalent to what we proposed. And they had this nice idea of saying we can, the way we can write down a model, a very flexible model, that has a giant tensor appearing in it that kind of looks like a wave function, is to take our vectors that have n components and lift them into this higher dimensional space that's a space of all binary bit strings. So you say, I have this space of bit strings, S1, S2, S3 through Sn. Each of these variables, these S1, S2, et cetera, can take two values. So I have all these different binary strings, so there's 2 to the n of these. And then what those are parameterizing is telling me whether I take each component of x. So if S1 is 0, I skip X1. But then if S2 is 1, I take X2, I might also take X3 and X7 or something like that. So I select some components of X and multiply them all together, and then I weight that with some weight W with a subscript of all that bit string. So the weights have the form of an n-index tensor, you know, indexed by all these different bit strings, and then the those are weighting different terms in a high-order polynomial that, you know, that parameterizes very high-order, very expressive polynomial. Okay. So,
I just wanted to clarify, so any x with s index s equal to 0 equals to 1.
That's right. It means you just don't put that x in. Yes. And then if it's 1, you do put that x in. And you could, of course, generalize this. You could let s go to 2, 3, 4 if you wanted and have higher powers of the x's. So that's a possible generalization. OK. So then let me be concrete about it. Let me show you the example, the whole model written out for the case that the input is three-dimensional, so meaning there's just three components to this x. So then I write out the model, and it's just got a constant term. It's got a term with weights times just single x components, then weights times pairs of x components, and then finally one weight times all of the x components multiplied together. And then what's nice about writing it out this way is that you see this first row is this thing called the linear classifier. Who's heard of the linear classifier model in machine learning? So it's just basically saying I have weights that are like a dot product with x itself. That's the linear classifier, right? So it's just, you could call it, you know, L of x is some kind of b plus v times x. That's the linear classifier. So that's already included for free in this model. And the linear classifier can already do very well on a lot of challenging data sets. So you can give it a pretty tough data set, and it can already maybe get you to like, you know, 80% accuracy or something on some task. But then the idea is that by having these higher order terms, you can keep pushing beyond that sort of baseline. That's the idea. OK. More generally, you can come up with very expressive models of the same form by instead of making your features, which means like how you represent your data inside the model, instead of your features just being powers of the x's, they can be different local functions wrapping those x components. So I can just have two functions, phi 0 and phi 1, that they could be just, you know, x to the 0 and x to the 1, but it could really be any two functions, phi 0 and phi 1. And I plug all my components into these functions, and I still get this big weight tensor in front that's telling me which of those two functions I take and apply to each of these components. So that's the idea that we had more specifically. And so in particular, we kind of thought of this map, me and David Schwab, which was kind of motivated by this picturesque idea of thinking of pixels of an image as spins or as qubits. And you may think that's kind of a goofy idea, and we thought so too, but we still went after it, and we found that the model you get is still pretty interesting. And the idea is that you just map each pixel to a two-component normalized vector, and then you make your model out of components of these normalized vectors. So it kind of looks like mapping your data to a product state wave function, and then classifying your data by overlapping it with some really complicated entangled wave function. That was sort of the picture we had. But in the end, it's really just that function I wrote down a minute ago. So really, you could say that there's a feature map. And a feature map just means how do you represent your data inside the model that maps the data from its original dimensional space to this much higher dimensional space, 2 to the n dimensional space, by wrapping it up into each of these two functions and then taking a tensor product of these functions. But really, I'm just saying it's like mapping classical data to a product state wave function, so to speak, although I'm not necessarily saying there's a quantum interpretation or anything, but just that it mathematically looks like that. So let me show you this in a few different notations. One way is to say, OK, you know, I take the components, I wrap them up in these two functions, I make these vectors, and then I tensor product them all together. I don't actually tensor product them all together, because that would be this 2 to the n dimensional long vector, but I just think of tensor producting them together. Or I can write it in tensor diagram notation by saying I map it to this product state. And that's what a product state looks like in this diagrammatic notation. And again, the reason I want to map it to a product state is because if I want my output to be a scalar, then my weights had better have a matching set of indices that I can sum over so that the result can be a scalar. And then the whole point of that was to get weights that look like a giant wave function or like a giant tensor with lots of indices. So it was really, that was the point of all that. But to get a really expressive model in the meantime as well. OK, and then the main point of doing that is so that we can use tensor networks somewhere in this model, because tensor networks are interesting and lead to powerful algorithms, et cetera.
What does the n correspond to, like in the, the column and rows? Or?
Mm-hmm. Let's see, the n, you mean like when I say here order n? Yeah, here n, yeah, earlier I used it with a different meaning, but here n means the number of indices. So it's actually the dimensionality of my input. So it's like if my image has 1,000 pixels, n is 1,000. Yeah, or I could have 1D time series data with 1,000 samples, and then n would be 1,000.
So row times the column?
No, I just mean, did you say lowercase m? Or?
Connect with what you show at the beginning, where you have a bunch of ones, a bunch of twos, a bunch of threes. So what would this n be if you have that problem?
Yeah, so if you have the problem of a bunch of images, it's a good question, of a bunch of images, then those images are 28 by 28. So then they have something like 784 pixels, I think is the right number. That's n. It's like the number of pixels. And then you also have a training set size, which on the later side I'll call n sub t. It's like size of training set. So that's a good question. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
So when you use tensor networks, you have the minor Hamiltonian to minimize and then optimize your tensors. Right? Not quite.
So there's no Hamiltonian here. I mean, there could be, but I don't formulate it that way.
That's the condition I have. Like, you want to use tensor networks, but do you have any minimization condition in order to optimize them?
You do. So that's a slide I left out, but I probably should have put in. But I should put this in more context. So earlier I talked about supervised learning, unsupervised learning. So you have a function class, which this is the function class, is basically this function class, but it could be other function classes. And you want to solve some task. And the way you do this in practice is that you write a cost function. I mean, you know this, but I'm just for the benefit of everybody. You write a cost function that might say, like, I have my model F, and it has parameters W. And then, yeah.
I really don't see that with the weed. You should use it in chalk.
Oh, OK, hard to see? OK. Well, I can maybe just say it in words, though, that I have this function with a lot of parameters, and I also have some ideal function. The ideal function would just output, like, you know, exactly +1 for alligator images and exactly -1 for bear images, or something like that. So then all I do is I write down some norm that measures the distance of the function I currently have from that ideal labeling function, and that's easy to write down. And then that's like a thing you can minimize. It's just some smooth thing that depends on these parameters W, and I can just compute gradients of it, and I can find updates for these W's and all that. So that's what I do here. So there's no Hamiltonian. It's just that I take this class of functions that will involve a tensor network, then I think of the elements in this tensor network as just parameters, and then I can just do gradient descent or other algorithms to try to minimize some empirical loss function that, if I could minimize it really well, makes my function empirically, you know, do the task really well, basically, because I'm measuring the distance from it to some ideal task function.
So does this mean that the dimension of your x vector doesn't have to be the same as the number of your s vectors?
The number of indices does have to be the same here, at least the way I described it as the input size. You could duplicate, like I could take x3 and I could repeat it 3 or 4 times in a row.
Say distinguish between the alligator and the bear. I would not just have possibilities.
That's right. So in that case, you would need to make the images the same size, say, or pad them so that you can all input them in the same model. Then in that case, you only have two classes, so it's enough to have a scalar output to your function. And you could say positive means alligator, negative means bear. You can generalize this if you need to have multiple labels, like 10 labels, you can have a vector valued output, something like that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah, so there's all kinds of refinements and generalizations as well.
Miles, how do you know that it isn't making the decision on something spurious? Because on your alligators versus bears example that you had a few slides back, you can distinguish that particular set of photographs by counting the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Bears are showing 2 eyes, and all the alligators are 1 eye.
I like that. Yeah, I was thinking you were going to say that how much color green versus brown or something there is. That'd be another one.
Maybe two, but.
Yeah. No, this is a serious criticism. I mean, I heard a story about some early experiment with neural nets where they thought it was, you know, identifying certain vehicles, but it turns out it was always identifying the background around the vehicle. Like, certain vehicles would always be in remote woods, and the other ones would always be on roads. And so it was actually looking at the environment and not the vehicle or something. So it's a serious problem. That's one of the goals of this whole program. So one question people ask me about where all this is going, they'll say, okay, you're using tensor networks, you like tensor networks, fine, but do these work better than other things that we already have, like neural networks? And the answer is, I don't know yet. But I can show you some cases where they work at least very close to as well. But then, to me, the more interesting thing would be if they work differently in a way that could let us, say, gain understanding of, like, interpretability or better kinds of schemes to generalize, to ensure generalization, meaning like that things work outside of the training set for the right reasons. So I think we can. I think these have a lot of theoretical, I don't know, perspicacity or something. We can see through these a lot. We can understand their structure much better than more complicated classes of functions. And at the same time, I think there's a lot of reasons to expect they'll give good performance. So I believe or I hope that these will lead to a better understanding of the very problems you're talking about. But I can't right now show you that they do, but I think it's like a promising application. Thanks. Yeah. Okay, so then, so we reached now where tensor networks go into machine learning. So I motivated some class of models. I hopefully convince you these are very expressive models because they're like extremely high order polynomials. You can even put these functions phi around them. You can make very, very rich models. And they naturally let you approximate the weights by a tensor network because you have this lot of indices of small size, basically. So one tensor network you could use is a matrix product state. That's what I'll be using, just because it's a simple case. But you could also use a PEPS or a Mira or other things just as well. So I'm using a matrix product state just because it's something I already had code for. And if it works, then maybe how much better might a PEPS work or something like that. And you can use algorithms motivated from physics, from the physics literature, to optimize these things. That's a key motivation. So in particular, you can use an algorithm that's kind of motivated by, it's different from, but it's motivated by DMRG, which is the algorithm I showed that movie of. And the key thing about DMRG is that it adapts the number of parameters in the matrix product state. And you can kind of go through the steps and convince yourself that the scaling is linear in the dimension of the data and in the size, the number of training examples that you feed in to train with. Basically, because you just compute a separate update for each one. And so the way the algorithm works in a nutshell is that I start with the model in this form where the weights now are a matrix product state. I merge two of the tensors together, and you'll see why in a second why I do that. Merge them together, then I compute a gradient just for that pair, and I just leave the other ones fixed temporarily. So they're just kind of in the background. I get a gradient just for this pair. I apply that gradient maybe a few times to improve it for whatever cost function I'm optimizing. Then the DMRG part is that I split them back apart. And when I do, I can do this analysis in that factorization of the singular values. And this is an SVD that you do. I mean, these are some details. But the idea is at that point, that dimension, that matrix dimension linking those two tensors together can actually grow and shrink. And it can do that based on whatever is optimal for solving the problem, based on that improved tensor that I computed. And I can do this on every bond and then keep going back and forth. And after I do this, I can find that maybe all the bonds grow for a while, then some of them saturate and other ones in the middle keep growing. And basically, it can reflect back to me the complexity of the problem and only use just enough resources to solve the problem and like no more. That's already kind of neat. Okay, and then also for people who are kind of hard-nosed about this, they might say, why should this work at all? People who know about the idea of the area law, ground states, where is the gapped local Hamiltonian in this story? Why would this work? So I can't like prove to you that it will work, and it probably doesn't work for every problem you can think of. However, the idea is that if you think about the linear classifier and you say, the linear classifier already works pretty well in lots of in a broad set of cases, you can precisely map the linear classifier to a bond dimension 2 matrix product state. So you can find a matrix product state where all the matrices have size 2 by 2 that precisely reproduces linear classifier. So then the idea is that if the linear classifier works reasonably well for a lot of problems, then how much better might a bond dimension 3 or 10 or 100 matrix product state work, or a PEPS or something like that? So it's like guaranteed to give you linear classifier plus a whole lot more as you go up in bond dimension or latent space dimension of these tensor networks. Okay, and then just to convince you that it does work, we tried this experiment where we took this MNIST handwriting data set, we kind of unrolled it into 1D just to use matrix product states. That's not a very natural thing to do, but it's just because we wanted to do something simple, use matrix product states. We optimized the number in the matrix product state using the squared error, and then we got 99% accuracy on the training set, which is 60,000 images. Then when we transferred this model over to the test set, which we didn't use in the training, we still get 99% accuracy on the test set, which means only 97 images wrong out of 10,000. So it worked really well. We're very happy with that. So now let me briefly tell you about some follow-up work that came out of that. So that was in 2016. Any questions real fast about what we did there? Okay.
What's the domain of your matrices?
Oh yeah, I should have put that on here. So the matrices, these tensors that make this chain, we had to push them up to bond dimension 120 to get this result. So that's not so big, actually. Like in physics, we routinely take that up to like 500 or 1,000 or even 30,000 or something. So we were very happy that it only required bond dimension like 120 to get this result. However, we did use this full gradient. We didn't get stochastic gradient working. So every iteration of the optimization, we had to loop over 60,000 images, 60,000, 60,000. So that was a huge overhead. And it still, it was pretty fast, but you know, I think on the one hand that's bad. On the other hand, that shows major room for improvement, I would say. I'd be an optimist and say we can make this thing 60,000 times faster potentially, actually. So I think it's just a matter of getting stochastic gradient working, which is tricky, but I think it can be done. We just have to get better at it.
How susceptible is this to overfitting?
That's a good question. So we didn't see much evidence of overfitting here, but I think MNIST is too easy for that. I've seen it massively overfit for, I tried CIFAR-10. I didn't get it up to a very good accuracy, but I saw a huge drop from training to test with CIFAR-10.
So you say training error you had was really the highest, so it was saturating at 99.95, even if you would crank up the one.
Yeah, we couldn't get it to start to drop. Like, so even if we would train more and more and more, we couldn't get the test error to ever go down. It was always still going up. And there's been some more recent work that speaks to this.
100%.
But I will mention that there's this paper by Lei Wang and Pen Zheng in Beijing that came out more recently where they were able to report overfitting with matrix product state. So I recommend reading that paper. So this is the part where I'm just going to quickly flash through some follow-up work that people have done. Kind of running out of time, so let me kind of just go through these quickly and we can come back to some of these if people have more questions. So since we wrote that paper and other people, I mentioned there were these two other papers by the group of Shashua, Cohen, and other people, and also this group, Novikov, Osilades, we all kind of hit on this idea around the same time, and now I've been pleased to see there's a lot of people who got interested in this idea and some interesting follow-ups. So one of them was a follow-up by that one group I mentioned, Shashua's group. This is a group of machine learning researchers actually in Israel who got interested in tensor networks like independently from me, and they've been studying, they have a series of papers, but this is one that I like, where they study a certain family of neural networks, which are actually identical to tree tensor networks, which are kind of like a tree version of a matrix product state, basically. And these have been used a lot in physics as well. And what they're interested in is doing theory. So they want to know what is like the capacity of a model to represent more and less complex data. So they have some theoretical proofs about this, and they're understanding that the rank of a tensor, meaning the size of the bond, somehow constrains its expressive power. This is related to, in physics, we have this idea about entanglement and how much information can a tensor network carry about two halves of a system. They also do a nice experiment on what they call the inductive bias of a model architecture, meaning like how primed is a certain model architecture for a particular class of data. So they find that if they take the tree and make the bond dimensions either big at the bottom getting smaller at the top or small at the bottom getting bigger at the top, then those two different models perform, one performs better than the other and then vice versa in two different cases where they have kind of zoomed in images and zoomed out images. So they find that there's different patterns of these bonds which sort of can adapt for different types of tasks. And then that tree model could actually be made adaptive if you do kind of a generalization of DMRG. They didn't do that, but it would be a nice use of that adaptive algorithm. It would basically discover one of those two model architectures automatically. That would be interesting. This is another nice paper where these authors had the idea of saying, why don't we take this analogy of tensor networks to wave functions more literally and demand that the square of this tensor network is the probability. I mean, that's just a choice. It's not like you don't have to use tensor networks that way, but that is how we use them in quantum physics. But when you do, you actually get a lot of algorithmic benefits. There's this idea I can't go into about gauging a tensor network that only kind of makes sense in this squaring formalism. Also, there's this freedom you have where you can put minus signs everywhere in the network, which lets you do better optimization, and yet you're still protected from having minus signs in your probabilities. So this is in contrast to this field called graphical models, where you have to constrain all your entries to be non-negative. So it's like a nice kind of generalization of graphical models. So they call this a Born machine, in contrast to a Boltzmann machine, because it uses the Born rule. You can do very nice things with this setup. You can do what's called perfect sampling, meaning you can just directly sample from the distribution rather than having to do some kind of Markov chain-based sampling. So you just directly sample. Very nice. And you can do things like reconstruct images showing a subset of the pixels. You can have it draw the rest. So really nice ideas you can do. This is another paper that had some nice demonstrations where these authors trained a tree tensor network on some data just doing supervised learning. But then they tried to look into the tree and figure out what had it learned. And one thing I liked is that they could see that at different scales in the tree, like at different depths, you could see that it was kind of disentangling the data. It's like, here it is in its kind of native representation. And as you go up and up and up in the tree and do this T-SNE visualization, you can see the data kind of separates out as you go up in the tree. And that's how the tree is distinguishing the different classes. This is a recent paper of mine just from January that I'll just briefly explain. But the idea was, can we get some insight into how, say, deep models work like in neural networks, but kind of a tensor network analog of those. And I had this notion, a lot of people have this notion, that maybe the lower layers of a deep model are just kind of figuring out how to represent the data in some more abstract way, independent of what it's going to do with the data. And then the top layer is more calling the shots and making decisions about what the data is. And the bottom layers are just kind of helping the top layer to do that. So I tried to kind of push that analogy by saying, why don't I make like a density matrix out of the data? So I represent all the data as a product state. Then I sum these like outer products of product states and make something like a density matrix. And this can all be motivated by this nice bit of theory called the representer theorem in statistical machine learning. You can motivate this object. And then you can basically use algorithms that were developed by people like Giffre Vidal here and Steve White to compute an optimal tree tensor network that optimally compresses this density matrix, this thing here in blue. And then you can compute this tree, and it's an unsupervised algorithm because you're just feeding it the data and computing these tree tensors. Then at the very top, you stop and you say, hold on, let's remember that this data has labels. Then you train an MPS across the top to be this discriminator that recognizes and distinguishes the different labels. And I tried this method out on a tougher problem called fashion MNIST, which is a collection of grayscale pictures of clothing items. And basically, if you look at like the distribution of performance of different state-of-the-art methods, there's a few that are up at like 94% on the test set, but most of the pack is around 89%, including lots of convolutional neural networks, decision trees, all these things. And my method also got 89%. So I was very happy. I was like right there competitive with lots of state-of-the-art methods like convolutional networks and things. Okay, so then in the kind of very short time remaining, let me just flash a few slides about quantum machine learning with tensor networks. And so this is mostly due to this very creative grad student named Bill Huggins, who's at Berkeley and kind of motivated me to work on this with him, trying to think about how tensor networks could be useful for machine learning with quantum computers. Let me also recommend this other recent paper, which proposes very closely related ideas by Grant and Benedetti. So there have been recent proposals. These all really pretty much only came out since January. So this is all pretty recent stuff by groups like this group at Google or this group at Xanadu, which is just down the street in Toronto, to do machine learning on a quantum computer in the following way. So one machine learning task is this family of supervised tasks where you say, I have some data, X, and I want to recognize it. So what I'll do is I'll prepare some qubits. That's the number of qubits is like the dimension of my input data. Then I'll devise a quantum circuit, which is like everything in this giant unitary here. I'm not going to say what the quantum circuit is yet, because these papers basically didn't say a lot about what the quantum circuit was. They just said, there is some quantum circuit that I apply. And then what I do is I observe, say, one or maybe two of the qubits at the end, and I measure it. And I do this a few times to kind of sample that qubit. And then if I get zero with high probability, I say it's an alligator. If I get one, I say it's a bear. That kind of thing. So the idea is instead of trying to like shoehorn a neural network or some known model into a quantum circuit, I just think of a quantum circuit as a type of model to do machine learning. And that's a nice idea, I think. Then there's another set of proposals that came out also basically either in December or just this past January. So these are all very recent to do generative machine learning. This is like where I want to learn the distribution and then generate samples from that same distribution. So here it's very similar. I also prepare some number n of qubits, which is similar to my, it's the same size as my dimension of my data. However, I just prepare them in some fixed way, like they're all in the zero state. Say that's what these triangles mean, it's just the zero state of all these qubits. Then I act on them with some other circuit, some generator circuit. Then I measure them all. And then that's one sample. And then I can just do this over and over again. So that's a proposal for generative learning. But there's some issues with these proposals that you might have already noticed. So one issue is what circuit should we use? I mean, that's a huge circuit, right? Especially let's say we have, you know, 1,000 qubits. I mean, if we ever could, because we want to load in, you know, 1,000 pixel images. That's a huge circuit now to try to parameterize and work with. What circuit should we pick? In fact, there's even a paper from March that's saying that this is very problematic, that if you pick a random circuit on n qubits, that it actually has this horrible vanishing gradient problem. You can't even begin to train it, so it's a big mess. So don't do that. Also, it requires too many qubits, right? Like, how many qubits are we really going to have? Can we really load, you know, images of 1,000 pixels into 1,000 qubits and then act on 1,000 qubits and all this? It's not very practical. So I was thinking about these issues, and Bill was thinking about these issues, and we were thinking about that the fact that tensor networks are actually completely equivalent to quantum circuits. So for any tensor network, you can map it to some kind of quantum circuit. So this is showing the exact mapping between a tree tensor network and the equivalent quantum circuit. So you can kind of see the tree layers here. And the idea is you have these ancilla qubits that kind of form the latent or hidden bond dimension indices going through. So you kind of group these two together, and that's a space of size 4. So that's like a tensor index of size 4 going through this tree. And you know, here's in particular the quantum circuit for a matrix product state, which is the kind of tensor network I explained the most in the previous slides. And this in particular is a quantum circuit for a matrix product state of bond dimension 4. And you can see this because you can see that each node is connected to the next one by two lines. So these two lines are 2 qubits. So that's two 2-dimensional spaces or a 4-dimensional space. So that's a bond dimension 4 MPS. So let me show you. That's the first MPS tensor, second one, third one, fourth one, so on. And the last one is kind of the last 3 qubits, say. You could do a few more if you wanted. So that's just a precise mapping between a matrix product state and a particular quantum circuit that you can think of. And so this suggests doing those ideas that I mentioned on the previous earlier slide, but with tensor network forms of the circuits. So for one thing, you get, this is misspelled, but you get many fewer parameters you have to optimize than an arbitrary circuit. However, you know it's in this interesting class of models that I already discussed and showed you works well for real tasks on real data. So we know these models already work, and you can, you know, put them into a quantum computer and work with fewer parameters. And in particular, you could even train these models classically, as I showed you that I already did, and use them to initialize the quantum models and then train them further on a quantum system. There's also a discriminative form in the model that we worked out. We tested the idea on just 2 of the digits of MNIST and got 99% accuracy training and test using only operations that you could actually do on a quantum hardware. So basically, it's more of like a random gradient thing where you sort of pick a random direction, you figure out which way to go along that random direction, and then you take a step forward or backward along that direction. So it's a lot slower, but it's all involving steps you can actually do with real quantum hardware. It doesn't involve any fancy subroutines like quantum phase estimation or quantum Fourier transform. It's just assembling a circuit, measuring qubits, and then repeating a lot of times, basically. And then the last idea I just wanted to mention with my negative time remaining is that what's the benefit of using tensor networks apart from fewer parameters and passing from classical to quantum is that you could actually do things where you could process very large inputs and outputs using only a very small number of qubits. And I think this is a neat idea. So basically, you could say, give me 4 qubits. I act on them with some unitary that I have to learn with the hybrid quantum classical algorithm. I measure 1, okay. The other 3 are still entangled with each other. Now I re-prepare the one I measured, entangle them all again, measure that first one again, re-prepare, entangle, measure, and do this a bunch of times. And then, even though I only had 4 qubits, I can actually generate many more than 4 outputs. And so then what is this doing? What's the idea here? The idea is that the other 3 qubits act as some kind of hidden state or some kind of quantum memory that would be exponentially big in the number of qubits I don't observe. And it turns out that's exactly equivalent to sampling from a matrix product state whose bond dimension is 2 to the number of these hidden qubits that I don't observe at each step. So that's just an idea that I want to actually try out now on some near-term devices, because you can actually get devices now that have more than 4 qubits. So I really want to try this idea out and generate from some toy distributions and things. So, okay, I'll conclude leaving up a summary. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. On one of your slides, you had a tensor network, and you made a comment about the entanglement between the two sides and some data, some digits.
Mm-hmm.
So are there some data sets that have area law entanglement while others are volume law?
It's an open question, but it's one that I think is enticing. Like, I have a feeling, I think a few groups might be working on this right now as we speak, like trying to show that, you know. Maybe not prove it, but I mean, there's some empirical work that needs to be done to like pick representative data sets, study, try to like quantify their entanglement. I will say this, that that we have this temptation as physicists to look at a tensor network and say, what is its entanglement? But I would push back on that a little bit and say, hold on, is it a wave function? You know, what is the entanglement of something that's not a wave function? You know, so
correlations.
Yeah, well, it's correlations, but then it's in this weird squaring formalism or something. So then it's actually not a big deal. I would just say that be careful to make sure you've chosen this Born formalism. Then I think you can talk about entanglement. Otherwise, you might just be talking about like some kind of rank of a decomposition of a large tensor, which is also an interesting quantity. But I mean, you know, I'm just saying let's be careful a little bit about that, using that word. But I think it does have a meaning if you put it in the squaring context.
You have to define properly phase of wave function, because it's necessarily complex, but is that necessarily real?
Well, that does raise the question of like, do we need that formalism? Like, do we need to have negative signs and phases? Does that give some benefit for modeling. I mean, I think I can at least very strongly argue that just being able to work with negative signs and stuff gives you a practical benefit in terms of what algorithms you can do. In particular, you can use the singular value decomposition all throughout your algorithm, which is something we routinely do with tensor networks. And the singular value decomposition will generically leave minus signs everywhere. So I actually found an interesting paper, or I was shown an interesting paper from the graphical model community, where some authors devised an algorithm that's like equivalent to DMRG, but for graphical models. And there's a nice sentence in the article where it says, we would like to use the SVD because it would be the optimal thing to do at this step, but we can't, so we use this non-negative factorization, and it goes on. And I'm like, oh, well, we can use the SVD in our approach. So that's, you know, that's a concrete reason to like square. Okay, yeah.
Just one quick comment. Very often condensed matter people use the term entanglement, even though the distinction between entanglement and separable state is actually not that important. It really just kind of means correlations.
But yeah, that's right. That's true. Yeah.
So totally separately, I'm totally persuaded. I love this stuff. I'm totally biased. I love this stuff much more than just the kind of general neural networks that I've seen, which seem much messier and harder to understand. What are the things that you think are the hardest or like it's kind of like key things that maybe you can't do with a tensor network?
So, yeah.
There's some sort of key nonlinearity that you're missing.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I mean, like, yeah, what's the challenge points here? You know, I tried to show you the good things, right? So the key thing is like, you know, algorithms for training on huge data sets, like, can we do ImageNet with this? ImageNet involves like hundreds of thousands of training images and 1,000 labels and these really complicated images. So are we in bad shape there? Because the biggest worry I would have is that I think we can improve the algorithms a lot. Like, I'm pretty confident we can get stochastic optimization working to deal with this training set size bottleneck. And maybe we can come up with even better algorithms than that, actually. The problem is, will we run into the same issues that right now in physics tensor networks are running into, where we can do 2D, but it's really hard, it's really tough sledding? Are we going to have the same problem? I have reasons to think that we're in a better situation here, because in particular, when I attach a product state, my data, to a PEPS, like this 2D tensor network, it's still a single layer of PEPS. It's just one layer of tensors of whatever internal bond dimension they have. Whereas in physics, we have to wrap the Hamiltonian up with two PEPs on both sides, bra and ket. And then now we have this double layer PEPs. So all the dimensions of these indices is now d squared, which gets raised to like the fourth power or something. And it's very expensive. So I think already the scaling should be better just by virtue of being in this formalism. So I think we can get PEPs working. You know, so I think we'll have a lot of expressive power, at least for 2D. I don't know about, you know, like 4D data. That might be really hard. But I mean, I really am very optimistic right now. I don't think there's any reason to think that these can't just keep performing on tougher and tougher problems. You know.
One way of testing is, say, if you take your grid and you shuffle your edge points around so that your matrices are connecting totally distinct points.
That's an excellent idea, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to try that, or someone should try that. So you mean, yeah.
It would be a it does not matter how you shuffle these things. If that's true, then it looks like it's very powerful. It's very critical. Mm. It depends on how you sort your points.
Mm. That's a good point, and it gets to your question about right now, this matrix product state snaking through the image could be kind of cheating. Like, it could be leaning too hard on certain vertical column features in the data or something, and if we shuffled the data around, we could prevent it from being able to do that, maybe. And we could see more about its representative power as well. It's a good idea.
Well, I just got confused about this quantum machine learning because,
sure. Yeah.
Like in the end, you were saying that you managed to do everything with 4 qubits, okay? But before that, I got an impression that, say, for example, if you want to use quantum this tensor network to train, for example, an image. To train on an image dataset, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the number of qubits has to be, say, comparable to the number of pixels in an image.
Yeah, that's right. So, good question. I mean, the idea here is that you, instead of, that's because I was thinking there of saying that's true about the earlier models I showed, but there it's because I just think of you know, mapping all my data to a product state and then overlapping it with some wave function looking tensor. But the thing is, there's no reason why I can't apply those tensors one at a time. I mean, I can prepare the first component of that product state, apply the first DMPS tensor, then the second. You know, I can even do that in the classical algorithm, do them one at a time. That's the idea here. So the idea here is that, sure, I could prepare them all and apply them all, but I could also prepare them one at a time. The fact that the tensor network factorizes this way gives me that freedom to do that. And that's what lets you get this better qubit efficiency.
It's analog of convolutional neural network. Like a convolutional neural network applies to the same ways to like different parts of an image, right? So maybe is it, are you talking about?
It might have a relationship to that. It could, but this is just a very general thing, though. So it depends on what you put into the unitaries, whether it's doing that or some other thing. Also, this is a generative thing where you're just generating, but you can also flip it around, and we wrote down a discriminative version of this as well. Yes?
Can I pick up on Marcel's point from a couple of questions back? If you go around shuffling everything like that, it's just like the opening move for proving De Finetti's theorems, and I think that implies things about separability. So if you reckon that entanglement is going to be helpful, that is going to break it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good way to, yeah, you're right. That would definitely, that study would feed in a lot to the idea of like how like entangled is the data. That's a good idea. Yeah, exactly. So you may see that certain permutations are okay. Maybe if they're just all in like local patches, but if we just do a random shuffle of the pixels, maybe it breaks down. That'd be interesting to study. Yeah. I think it's a great idea.
So far you talked about MPS. Have you tried Meta?
So Mira has some issues. It's interesting, right? So I think one thing that's interesting about this is that we have to kind of rethink a lot of the field of tensor networks in this setting. So Mira is very clever because it's like taking something that's not a tree, so you'd think it would be intractable, meaning you can't efficiently evaluate its norm. But because the things that make it not a tree are unitary, they all cancel, and then you can get the norm. However, in some sense, when you try to attach a product state to a Mira and then get the overlap, formally speaking, that's not efficient because you have to now contract all the tensors in the mirror to get that number. Now, practically speaking, you could still probably do that by thinking of that product state as an MPS and thinking of the mirror layers as some like time evolution of that MPS and just carrying that out. So I think you can still approximately contract mirrors, and so then I think there's a way to use them, yeah. And I haven't tried it, but in particular, where it would be maybe the first place I would try it would be this paper, this algorithm. There's no reason at all why I couldn't have made a mirror instead of a tree. It's just that a mirror is harder to make. So I just thought, well, if it works with a tree, it'll work even better with a mirror. So I just wanted to do something quick to kind of argue the point. But this would be a great place to put a mirror instead.
It's not clear to me what the quantum computer, what benefit you would get, because you have your polynomial scaling algorithm. So where does the quantum computer fit in as benefit?
That's a really good question, too. So I thought about this, and at first I was excited, then I was dismayed because I thought, wait, like, if we need so many parameters, like exponentially big bond dimension, then can we ever even train a model that really uses all those parameters in a meaningful way? I haven't figured this out yet, so I think it's a frontier question in my mind of like, is there a quantum advantage at all to this setup? Is there any benefit? One thought I have about it is that let's say you know you can do really well by going up to bond dimension, 16,000 or something, and maybe that's the limit of what you can do classically, and you're running out of gas really bad, and you're running out of memory. And then you're like, if only I could go a little past that, I could really solve this problem. So then you put one more qubit, and now you have bond dimension, about 30,000 or something, and now you can. And so the idea is it might be more useful in that intermediate regime where it's just a little past what you can do classically, but still not such a crazy model that it's way over-parameterized and will overfit everything. And we do have problems like that in physics where we really would like to do bond dimension like 60,000 and that would really help us or something. The other thought is that there may be this distinction between how big this hidden quantum memory is and then how many parameters are in the unitary. So maybe that the memory is very big, like it's some register that can hold lots of states, but then the little things inside these unitaries that's manipulating that memory maybe implement very simple rules. So maybe they just shuffle all the bits over or count or something like that. So maybe the parameters are not very many, so you can train it, but it can like do this simple counting rule on this exponentially big counter memory space. And so maybe you can carry very, very long correlations using very simple rules or something like that. So maybe that's a way, so the quantum advantage there would maybe have to do with just like how much it can hold in its memory, not like the actual number of parameters or something. So, but I don't know. Someone could probably tell me who works in that area whether that makes any sense, actually. So, yeah.
Last question.
Okay.
A little bit sci-fi. I mean, like the archetypical machine learning framework is a literal brain, right? Which is a classical.
Yeah.
So it would be kind of confusing if like qubits had a quantum advantage over.
Well, I mean, that's why I'm a bit more in the camp that is less. I'm less motivated by this biologically inspired machine learning idea. I mean, it's a neat idea, but I don't think we should have to implement machine learning using only biologically inspired ideas?
Work, right? So like, if brain, if you needed a quantum computer to do this, then
yeah, I mean, brains do work, but we also have wars and poverty, so I mean, they don't always work. So you know, so I mean, I just think, you know, I have more of an engineering attitude of like, we have quantum computers, let's use them, you know. So then the whole idea of that small qubit motivation was to say, what could we do already now with like the IBM quantum computer where you can do those single qubit measurements, you know. It's a good question, but you know, I think it's fun to think about how we could use them.
No, there's a relation between, say, what dimension of these lattices and, say, the dimension of the qubit. Like, qubit has always dimension two, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of very much dimension.
Yeah, that's right. But it'll be powers of two, but, you know, that's okay. So.
Okay, I think that's a good point to stop, and we can hang around in the bistro afterwards. So let's thank Miles again.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.